Well, the world is a dumpster fire. Nothing here makes sense. And you vacillate between crippling fear and constant self-defense. And nothing's right and nothing's good. And you're paralyzed with grief. Don't kill yourself, just have a cup of coffee.
Welcome to Coffee Over Suicide, the dramedy podcast about mental illness and choosing life over death one cup of coffee at a time. I'm your host, Chris Parker Howard. And today on the show, I have got the author of the book, How to Live When You Want to Die, Leanne Hull. And this book really hit home for me because I was at her son's age, on the other side of her story. I was a suicidal teenager. And I remember how immediate and how important those feelings felt at that time. I can still tap into that almost. The feeling that everything matters so much. The lack of experience in life that lets you believe that everything that's happening right now is a forever problem, that these things aren't going to go away, that you've got just a couple of options because there are no other options and there's no time to wait. I remember all of that. And like I said, there are some days I can still tap into that. And I think that it's an incredibly sad act to go through. I don't really feel comfortable saying that suicide is selfish. There are a lot of reasons why someone might feel like this is the option that makes the most sense for them. And the trouble with that is, as true as that feels when those emotions hit you, it's not true. There are always places that you can go to get help. There are always resources available. There are always people, even complete strangers, who would do anything in their power to help you through a rough moment. So don't hesitate to reach out. Now, that said, I know this sounds like it's going to be a really, really heavy episode, as sometimes they can be, but it's not overly heavy. There's a lot of hope on the other side of grief. There's a lot of beauty in remembering the wonderful things about the people that we've lost. And learning to get yourself through all of that so that you're not constantly thinking about the negative bits, the sadness, and all of that. And we get into all of those things and some techniques that she's gone through to get her through the other side of her grief. And there's a lot more of those things available in her book, which is out and available now. There's a link in the feed below, as well as on our Facebook page. CoffeeOverSuicide.com is another place you can go to get some information, and LeanneHull.com is somewhere you can go for some information. But that said, we're going to get into this conversation. And like I said, I know it sounds like it's going to be real heavy and real difficult. And I'm not going to lie, there's some parts where it is that. But, there is some light on the other side of this darkness, and we get into the light too. So without further ado, this is my conversation with the incredibly, incredibly wonderful Leanne Hull.
Hi,
morning.
Good morning, Chris.
This book that you've written it's really intense. There's a lot to get into. But I want to go back just a little bit. Tell me a little bit about you. Where did you grow up?
Phoenix, Arizona. Still living there. My husband works out of state, so I do some traveling to wherever he's at and traveling to speak. But our home base is still Phoenix, Arizona. All these years later. Yeah.
What was your family like?
Well, it was pretty small. It was just my mom and myself all my life. She raised me as a single mom, and I didn't have any other siblings or a dad. So it was really kind of interesting in the sense that she was a corporate woman, and that gave me a lot of opportunity to be around a lot of other adults and to experience some travel and some other things. So it was it wasn't normal, for the rest of my friends, but yeah. It was certainly made me feel special because it was just my mom and myself. So she always made me feel like I could do anything and that I was the most important person in the world. So that was really nice to grow up that way.
what were you into at that time? I mean, the traveling sounds like it would be something that would occupy you pretty well.
Well, when I was little, we really didn't do a lot of traveling because she was getting her master's degree. So just spent a lot of time. I played softball. I was involved in chorus and band, really just normal. You know, we ran around the neighborhood like kids used to do all night long and played kick the can in the cul-de-sac and rode our bikes up to the baseball fields at our school and had played ping pong in the cafeteria and snow cones. I mean, it was really pretty awesome. It was just laid back and great.
Yeah. Yeah. There's something special about, getting out and being active.
Yeah.
You know, it's something that, you definitely take for granted.
Yeah. Really encouraged my kids as they were growing up to make sure that they weren't sitting in the house playing video games, you know, that they, I mean, it's a little more terrifying these days to let your kids run around. But we tried to pick neighborhoods where we felt at least fairly comfortable with that, where there were a lot of kids and the kids could be out playing. I really thought that that was important in their growing up.
Well, tell me a little bit about that. I mean, let's get into it. So if you could tell me, what kind of a kid was Andy?
Oh, well, he was our fourth child. So he came along later in life. We had our first three kids by the time I was 25. So boom. And then Andy came along 11 years later. And that was actually really pretty special because we were, you know, we were more mature and we were better off financially. So things were definitely easier with him. And he was almost like an only child as well, because the other three were so much older and already involved in their activities.
Yeah.
So he was an easy kid. Just brought a lot of sunshine and joy to our lives. And because we were better off financially, we'd owned and operated our own business for, 20 plus years by that time. And so we were doing pretty well, and it allowed us the flexibility. We actually did do a lot of traveling with Andy out of the country, but the Bahamas, Hawaii, and that was a really, I'm so thankful for those memories that we have with him, and just lived as much a life as we could. I mean, not knowing that it was going to be cut short at the age of 16. So he was involved in all kinds of things. He was one step short of being an Eagle Scout. My husband was the committee chairman for Boy Scouts. Andy was a youth leader at church. So he went to winter camp, summer camp, church camp, had a lot of friends there, real strong faith base. He was, really more famously known as being a left-handed pitcher. And towards the end there, he was being scouted by the Dodgers, the Royals, Annapolis, West Point, Kansas State. I mean, everybody.
Oh, wow.
He was just a really dynamic athlete. He could do backflips on his wakeboard out on the lake. He was really an adventuresome type kid, just full of life and just lots of friends, and loved every minute of the day.
Yeah. What was the conversation about mental health up to that point? Was that something
none.
That none, like even none. Like around your mom and everything? You didn't really have a history with that.
No. I mean, it was. I'd never known anybody. I really hadn't known anybody that had died up until I got older than my grandma and grandpa passed, but
yeah,
never experienced death, and nobody in our family had experienced any kind of depression or mental health issues. So, I mean, it wasn't something. We had the normal conversations about drugs and alcohol and sex.
Sure, yeah.
Nothing like, and even with Andy, I mean, it just wasn't, we didn't know any other kids that had died by suicide or really drug overdoses or anything like that. So it was wasn't on my radar screen at all.
Yeah. And that was it. Were there any, I mean, looking back, there's always that,
right.
You know, that you start picking things apart and wondering if you missed things. And
oh yeah. The saying hindsight is 20/20. Of course I can see some things now. And that's primarily why I do what I do, is because had anybody, you know, I do a lot of speaking on that. What were some of the signs? Not because I am dwelling on that, because I recognize that I can't undo what happened.
Right,
and so I have to move forward. But if I can save other people's kids by forcing the conversation, by talking about it everywhere I go, to the bank teller, to at Starbucks, everywhere I go, you know, I kind of tend to lead people into asking me questions so that I can tell them I lost my son to suicide. And then we can have that conversation that maybe had anybody had that with me, I don't know, maybe I would have seen some of the signs, but they were really minuscule, easily confused with normal teenage angst.
Of course.
They were really very short-lived. So it was a four-month window of when things started to change to, you know, the end of his life.
Yeah. Yeah. The thing about this that's always difficult for people to talk about. Because I know that when I was a teenager, I was a suicidal kid. And I, from a really early age, and I didn't really know what to do with it.
Yeah.
And the conversations were things my parents didn't really quite understand. I guess we were all lucky because eventually we all kind of stumbled through it.
Right. And you're still here.
And I'm still here. Yeah,
that's
exactly.
That's amazing. That's really good.
But it was a tough time. And the thing I do remember is I remember the look on my dad's face the second time I had to go into the hospital, and I just remember him. I've never seen his face so powerless
right.
before or since ever. And you know, he was a psychology person. He was a counselor. So he understood a lot of these things. But it was like, yeah, after you hit a certain point, it's really up to the individual. But the thing about that makes it tough, especially when you're a kid, is you don't recognize that there's a chance that all of this could get better.
Yeah. You have no experience to draw upon.
Right.
But you know, even as an adult, and that's why I wrote the book, that's why I titled it the way that I did, you know, How to Live When You Want to Die, because
yeah.
I wanted to be real about the fact that I wanted to die every day after Andy did.
Yeah.
And that was... I wanted people to understand what that really looked like, because it was, I'm sure for you too, it's horrifying to think that you could want to end your life.
Yes.
And I did, and I looked at it, and I saw it, and I felt it, and I recognized the things I recognize a couple of things that are really important. One is that it's extremely difficult to get help for yourself when you're in the midst of a crisis, because people always say, well, why didn't Andy just ask for help, or why didn't he tell someone? And I didn't understand that until I felt it.
Yeah.
And then the other saying, well, it's such a selfish act. You know, when I was thinking about ending my life, I have other kids. I have other grandkids. I have a husband now of 39 years. We have a business. We have everything. And in those moments, nothing. I wasn't thinking about anybody else or anything else. I just wanted to stop feeling how bad I felt.
Yeah.
And it wasn't selfish. It wasn't about one. I certainly didn't want to hurt anybody, as neither did Andy. Andy would never have wanted to hurt me or any of his friends. There wasn't a selfish bone in my kid's body. None of
right.
it. And so those are some of the things I want to dispel and help people understand, that mental health is no different. My daughter has diabetes. We would never deny her insulin. And we would never look down upon her because she has diabetes. And yet we look down upon people who are struggling, whether it's situational or ongoing long-term depression. And we have to get past that if we're going to change the statistics.
Absolutely.
Stop the statistics. So.
Yeah. I mean, you wouldn't tell your daughter she's selfish for wanting her insulin.
No.
I mean, there's something in the wiring that's not going on quite right. And, you know, the other thing that I tell people all the time is that when you're in that situation, it doesn't feel like selfishness. It feels like you're on the top floor of a building that is burning below you, and you see it as, well, I can wait for the fire to reach me, or I can jump.
Right.
And it feels real when it's happening to you. That pain, that grief, that fear, all of that feels real.
I think it was really important for me to be able to experience that so that I had authenticity when I do speak, because I speak to so many people about this subject that if I really didn't understand it, you know, I would have lacked a degree of compassion or empathy or really relatability. I mean, I think that was, that's very interesting that I have been able, if you want to say that, to experience the depths of those. I don't so much think about that anymore. It was a daily thing for the first couple years.
Sure.
And now it can still be triggered even now. I don't know about you, but I think once you have actually thought about it or felt it, I think there are moments, things that happen in our lives that you kind of, that maybe passes across your brain for a moment, fleeting thoughts, and it makes us more susceptible to it, the triggers that come along.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the difference is I've got, decades of work under my belt now.
Yes. Yeah.
And so I recognize these things when they come past, and you know, that I'm just going to get through it. With one of the tools that I've got available to me at any given time. But it's taken years to build up an arsenal. Now that said, even though I have ways to get through, it doesn't make those feelings any less potent.
No, that's what I try. I try to help people understand the difference between our feelings and emotions and our decisions. And the bridge are those coping tools that you're talking about. And so what you have to do is at least cross the bridge with whatever tool. And one doesn't work every day. Like you said, you have to have an arsenal. What worked yesterday may not work today, so I've got to pull out a different tool.
Yeah.
And then by using that, I'm at least on a different level to where I can look at that emotion differently and go, okay, this is now what I'm going to do to process that feeling. Not fix it, but process it. And even anticipating those times when I know I'm going to be triggered, like Andy's, his angel date or his birth date or just holidays in general. You know, I do plan for those, and I recognize now that leading up to them is not going to be pleasant.
Yeah.
But almost instantly, the day after, they're gone, the feelings. And it's like, phew. And so I hold on to that knowledge. Like you said, you have perspective.
Yeah.
And you can see, you know, that it's going to feel differently in a day or two, or maybe even a week. Sometimes it's lasted as long as 6 weeks for me, to where I felt like the cloud has lifted again. Not so much, not so often anymore, but even last year, I mean, I felt like I had a cloud over me for about 6 weeks.
Yeah.
And then it was gone. It was just gone. But I had to use all of those tools every day to make sure that I didn't act upon those feelings. You know, you can't be a passive participant in this journey. You have to be in the driver's seat with your mental health.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's of the utmost importance to take an active role in yourself.
And it's exhausting too at times.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about when you started writing. How did that start for you?
It's funny because people have now, my book's been out not quite a month, and people have said, oh, that must have been really cathartic for you to write it. No, I didn't. I wrote it for you after I'd gone through the cathartic moments. So I didn't start writing it till 3 years afterwards. And I felt like, wow, okay, I learned so much about this process, these tools. How did I survive? What things did I do? How could I? And I wanted to share those with people, not just so that they wouldn't die by suicide, but I felt like the book would relate to anybody who had experienced or might be experiencing a trauma, like a divorce, yes, an infidelity, a bankruptcy, whatever drops you to your knees. You know, for me, obviously, it was losing my child, but for anybody else, it could be a different scenario. And so these are some of the, I wanted people to see you can be in the midst of the worst storm possible and still have hope that the storm's going to end, and that these are some of the tools that you can use to get to hang on until the storm lifts.
I think it's important for us to share our stories of coming out the other side of traumatic events.
Oh, yeah, because for me, the first year, you know, everybody and their brother wanted to hand me a book on grief, and I tried not to be rude, but I certainly didn't want to read any stupid books on grief. I was living it. I read 80 books that first year after Andy died, and they were books of other people's stories in how they survived, because I wanted the tools that they had. I wanted hope. I wanted that other person that could maybe show me the way in this darkness, and I certainly didn't want to read about the darkness.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's the funny thing about that. It's, you go looking for some answers, and you mm-hmm. find bits and pieces. And there's no one thing that is going to work for everybody. It's really just a matter of finding these pearls of wisdom in the things that are handed to you and the things that are given to you. But you've got to be looking for them.
That's exactly what I was just going to say. That's the problem, is so many people are waiting for their lives to get better or to change. And you and I both know you do. You have to be the seeker. I tell people, you know what, even if happiness and joy show up at your door, you still have to answer it. It still requires an action on your part. So I'll have people tell me, well, Leanne, I can't read, or... And especially after a trauma, I do understand that, because you have, for all intents and purposes, PTSD, and so your brain isn't working correctly, and it's hard to remember, it's hard to focus,
yeah,
it is hard to read. But that didn't stop me. I would have to reread a paragraph, sometimes five times, or, you know, put it down, start again, but I kept trying. So as long as you're doing something, you're right, not any... You know, there's no one way that works for everyone, but you do have to be looking.
Yeah, it is a constant process. I mean, if you think about it, even if you're not having issues with depression or sadness or anything like that, if you want anything in life, after a certain point, people aren't just handing things to you anymore.
No, No, I love speaking to businesses. I just had the opportunity to talk to a business group here last week, and it happens to be a construction group, and really this was their safety. I was invited to be part of their safety talk on mental well-being. And so for me, you know, I was able to share some thoughts about that. You know, everybody in the room, I asked, did everybody brush their teeth this morning? Well, yes, everybody did. Did everybody wear their seatbelt today? Yes. Did you put on your hard hat and your steel-toed boots? Yes. Okay, now, what did you do this morning so that you could prepare for a positive outcome today for your mental well-being? Did you do anything? Did you put anything in today that would help you? Or are you just showing up being the like the ping pong ball, waiting for whomever's going to hit you back and forth, and you're just feeling like you're not the captain of your ship? And mostly everybody does. Like you said, you don't have to be going through a trauma, just life in general.
Yeah.
People are not very attuned to being in the driver's seat. Hey, if you don't like your job, okay, quit sitting there being miserable, because it's nobody's fault but you. If you don't like it, make plans to either start a different career, to look for a different job. But for God's sake, quit complaining.
Yeah. Yeah, and that is something that I think there are all of these conversations that we have with people about trying to empower them and make them feel like they actually have the agency to go out and make a difference in their own lives. The part that I feel like is missing a lot of times in those conversations, and where sometimes people can feel like they're lost in the margins, is the part where you explain to them that you know it's not going to be easy, and that they're probably not going to get it right every single time, but to keep going.
Yeah. Yeah, this journey of losing Andy was certainly not easy to get to where I'm at right now. And it's the analogy of, okay, if we want to change our physical, our body, and we've decided to work out. Well, we understand that you can't go to the gym once and expect that everything's going to look different on your body. You're going to have to make a commitment to keep going and keep going for months, maybe years. And for me, it was I love telling the story about how I changed the power of my brain, because I didn't even know that it was possible what I was able to do. Andy took his life in our house, in his room. And so those images were really ingrained in my brain. And so every day when I would drive home from work, you know, those are the images that were flashing through my head. And if I was going to stay in my house, and my daughter and my grandkids, we all still lived there. We loved our house. If I was going to stay in this house, then that meant I had to change or figure out what to do with those images, or I was going to be haunted and destroyed, you know, forever.
Yeah.
And so I began a practice of when that image would come into my head. And even the image of when we were finally allowed back in the house, and you know, and I got to wrap my arms around my son in a body bag. Those are horrible images for anybody else. And for me now, I can talk about it. I even hesitate talking about it because I know it's so traumatizing for other people to think about it. But it doesn't hold me captive anymore, because what I did is every time I thought about that image, I picked another time with Andy that was the most amazing. It was just a few months before that, and he'd had this outing where he was pitching, and all of these scouts were there to watch him. They had scheduled to come and watch him, and they were literally lined up behind the backstop with their radar guns, and it was like something out of a movie. And I was pacing back and forth behind the bleachers watching him pitch, and he pitched the game of his life, lights out. And when he finished, see, I'm even getting goosebumps as I start to say it, he literally leapt off the pitching mound like a gazelle. Here's the 6 foot tall, 6 foot plus kid, man cub, leaping off the pitching mound. And it transforms me emotionally, chemically, physically, everything. And so I would literally play that vignette through my head And by the time I finished playing it, I was no longer there at my front door where I was. And I practiced that, and it took 2 years. I mean, I didn't know what the outcome, it was really just a temporary fix as I was doing it. It was some way to help me get through that process at the moment. But what was going on was I was rewiring, reprocessing those thought processes. So now I can't even stay there, you know, thinking about Andy in the body bag, because it's, he's already on the pitching mound. I'm already, my brain has already zoomed me over there automatically, and that's where I'm at. And so those mental images, we have the ability to change whatever is traumatizing us, whatever is difficult, whatever is, you know, gone on in our past or present, if we practice enough and have patience enough to persevere. And I'm astounded that that worked. I had no idea that power, but I had to, it was hard work, but I did it. And I tell people, I promise you, if you just practice it, you can change those mental images in your head as well.
Absolutely.
That was powerful.
It's extremely powerful. I mean, I just got chills listening to you speak about that as well, because I know exactly what that's like. You do have a choice on where you're going to put your focus as well, because you've got both of those images, and both of those things are true. Both of those things have happened. You've experienced them. They hold weight. But where are you going to put your attention, and where are you going to put your memories?
Yeah.
And choosing to focus on the positive isn't the same as ignoring or denying the negative. It's more a matter of making an active decision to remember the love, to remember the sweetness, the goodness, you know, the triumph of the moment of jumping off the pitching mound after. Yeah. You know, I mean, that's a decision, and it's not an easy decision, you know, because I imagine those traumatic images were a tough thing to push past, but you were actively working on that.
Yeah, I was. Everything that I did, every day that I showed up and faced something tough, it helped me to feel like I was gaining some control, because you feel so out of control when something like that happens. And so
it's everything, chaos.
Yes. And that felt terrible. Felt like I was never going to get my footing back. But then every, you know, going to the grocery store, when I went to watch the other boys play baseball, because they had dedicated the season to Andy that year, and consequently then the following year. And I thought, gosh, if these boys can do that and want to remember and honor my son, then I can, by God, I can show up. And let me tell you, that was the most excruciating thing, short of losing Andy, was to walk to that baseball field every day knowing that he wasn't going to be there. And then even worse was walking away back to my truck alone without my kid. When I'm looking and I'm watching all the other kids, all the other boys, and they're, you know, talking with their parents. But man, I learned so much about myself and the ability to prepare and live through. And even, you know, what was fun was in those moments when I was at the baseball game, you know, walking to it was really, that took a lot of preparation, and I had to prepare myself for it. And then I had to prepare going home. But in the moments when I was there, I could get lost in the fun of the game. And it was almost like I had an out of body experience watching myself as I was climbing the chain link fence, cheering, you know, and screaming. Yeah. And I'm thinking, gosh, Leanne, how can you be doing that when just 2 months earlier, your son died? And so I learned a lot about the human process, what we're capable of.
Yeah.
That was amazing for me to see that I could have that kind of momentary reprieve.
Well, and survivor's guilt is palpable.
Yeah.
Where did you start putting some things back together. Did you see a counselor or a therapist?
No, I didn't, but that doesn't mean that other people shouldn't. So I always preface that because...
But there's a lot of ways to do it is right. Kind of my point. There's a lot of ways.
Right. That I didn't feel like that was going to be the process that was going to help me. I did find a group called Helping Parents Heal, and I found them probably 2 months after Andy passed. And that helped me more, and being in the right group. So I attended a couple other, like Survivors of Suicide and Compassionate Friends, and those groups were not for me because they were really focused on the grief process, and that's not what I wanted to focus on. The Helping Parents Heal was focused on, that our children are still here in spirit.
Yeah.
And that was really a new thought for me. I mean, I had a faith base. So, in my mind, I knew Andy was in heaven, but I didn't know that he was also could be present here in spirit now. That was a big shift in my thinking. So that helped me a lot in maybe seeing signs from him that I recognized that I was getting signs from him early on. And like you said earlier, that didn't mean that I didn't miss him and that the sadness and pain was gone, but it did give me a glimmer of hope and helped me, it was just one other of the tools that helped me in moving forward. And then finding a focus, finding a purpose for, if you want to say, Andy's death. And so I started the nonprofit foundation. Well, I gave my first presentation 4 months after Andy passed, and his school, his principal, had asked me if I'd come and speak to the rest of the student body because they were worried about them, as we all were. Andy was extremely popular, and, we didn't want anybody to follow in their footsteps, and he thought that I would be a person that could deliver that message effectively. And so I spoke to 3,000 kids 4 months after Andy passed. And that really, I got so much response from the other kids. And then other schools started requesting me to come and speak. And then we did Andy's birthday was in April. He passed in December. And so trying to figure out what to do for that birthday. And so we did an event at a local amusement park where I thought, all right, I want to celebrate Andy's birthday, but I also want it to be an opportunity where maybe some of the other kids could get information like from Teen Lifeline or any kind of information on mental health or depression or suicide. So I recruited other organizations to be there, set up tables and have literature there for the kids and talk to them and we sold tickets for it. And we ended up raising $10,000 after all was said and done. And then
that's
it was
amazing.
Like, what are we going to do with that? And so we started the foundation and we gave away 10 $1,000 scholarships that year to graduating seniors at Andy's school. And we had them write You Matter essays on why they mattered as perceived by themselves, their peers, their family, and their friends. And how could they take that message forward and make a difference as they went on to college. And so it was amazing to read the essays. It was hard to choose, to whittle down to 10.
Yeah.
But that's how the foundation began. And that I could see that it was helping me to direct some of my sadness towards a place that could, where we could save lives and make a difference for what had happened.
Yeah. It's amazing that you were able to do what you were able to do. I mean, and that's not even to say that, people who get cut off at the knees by their grief are doing it wrong. I mean, everybody's going to do it their own way.
Right.
But, the people who step up and use their position and their experience to lift others, that's great.
Well, it's interesting too, though, because it's a double-edged sword. Because on one hand, it's doing a good thing, but on the other, I was losing friends. I lost my two best friends who just didn't feel like they could be part of my grief journey, and then there were those parents who felt like and would literally say to me, Leanne, you must not have had as close a relationship with Andy as I had with my kid. I'll never get over this. I'll never be able to move forward as you do. And that just makes me literally want to strangle him. Yeah. Because this is not about grief, love, loss. This is not about, it's the worst thing for anybody to compare their loss is being worse or more difficult or deeper or greater or whatever. I mean, I couldn't have been closer to Andy than I was. It couldn't have devastated and still continues to devastate our family. What our family's gone through since then is, you know, I don't even share it with most people because it's hard enough for them to deal with that I've lost a kid to suicide. But then if I tell them about all the other stuff, they're like, wow, okay.
Yeah.
I can't talk to you for sure, you know, because they can't process it. So there are times that it's lonely when you are doing some really good things like this because you set yourself up for the conversation and the things that maybe you don't want to hear from other people that can still be mean, even if they've just because they've lost a child or had a loss doesn't make them necessarily nice all of a sudden. So there's still yeah. mean and nasty people who have experienced grief and loss.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of layers to all of it. Oof. And when you start having these conversations with people who are unfamiliar, you immediately become an alien.
Yes.
People just don't know how to handle you. Like, should I say anything? what do right. I do? But it's a conversation that we need to have with each other. And we're seeing these numbers rise over mm-hmm. and over again.
30%.
Yeah.
30% this last year.
So it's a conversation that needs to be had. And especially for people who have experienced it in their lives. And, you know, the part of the reason that I started doing this in the first place on my end was because I felt this way for most of my life. And I put together tools and I did the work and, you know, read all the books and eventually came to the realization that I had to manage myself, that nobody yeah. was going to fix this, that I wasn't going to take a pill that was going to change me.
Right.
So it was a thought process that if I'm going to survive myself, I got to know how I work. And I figured it out. And, you know, when I needed help, I got help. When I needed some different tools, I got different tools. And you just wake up in the morning and you keep going. But I was looking for other people who were having these kinds of conversations.
Yeah, like-minded people.
Yeah. And I just didn't find anything that was doing it the way I wanted to hear it because it's all different. Yeah. So I said, well, I'll do it the way I want to hear it.
I like that. Well, and I'm sure you can agree with this, that it's one of the fallacies with mental health is people think that, or depression or whatever it is, that it's a once and done. Okay, so
right.
you're better now. You're fixed now. You're over it. And it, you're never,
no.
never. You're just, you're managing it better. You're managing it differently. You're making choices every day. And yet if I use that word, I have to be pretty cautious of using that word depending upon who I'm speaking to. If I'm speaking to parents who've lost kids and I tell them they have a choice, they tell me, Leanne, you're judgmental. I have absolutely no choice in how I feel. I lost my kid. It's the worst possible thing. No choice. And I try to tell them I'm not judgmental. I'm trying to let you know that I'm not commenting on the depth of your grief or sadness. I'm telling you that there are things that you can do and that you have to do if you want to ever have any change in how you feel. But there are some people that are very comfortable in staying in that place too, and you just have to let them. And like you said, you couldn't find people, so you go make your own way. Well, yeah. You may have to do that. You may have to leave people behind and go, all right, I'm going to make a new path for myself.
Well, and I understand those people that want to stay in the grief. I understand it. I don't agree with it, but I do understand it. I can empathize with it.
Yeah.
Because there is that feeling when you lose someone to suicide. Now, I've lost people to suicide. And it's one of those things where you feel like if you set the grief too far aside, it almost feels like you are abandoning.
Yes.
And you can't feel that way.
I remember the very first time that someone asked me how I was, and out of my mouth came, okay. And I thought, what did you just say, Leanne? What you said, okay. What the hell are you thinking?
Yeah.
You know, because it was a disconnect, and I didn't want anybody to ever think that I was over losing my kid. But what I realized then is that we associate that visible mourning process with loss, and consequently then how deeply we loved. And as soon as I understood that I could share how much I loved Andy by the joy, that was a really different place for me to be at. But I did have to let go of that sadness, that walking around with that look of woe on my face and never smiling again. And I figured the biggest thing is we don't want our loved ones to be forgotten.
Yes.
And the best way for me to do that is to honor him in how I'm living. How are they going to see Andy? Are they going to remember Andy either by the day he died, by the way that I look, or they're going to see who he was, the way he lived, by the way I'm living?
Yes.
And I wanted that. I wanted them to see Andy, not how he died, how he lived.
Yes, precisely.
That's up to me.
And that's exactly it. Walking around, with your carrying a boulder.
Yes.
Of grief and people saying, you know, you're not carrying the boulder today, so you must not care.
Right.
It is a thing that people do, but I think that it can be a thing that people do because we do sort of have a hard time quantifying pain and experiences amongst each other.
Right.
It's a very individual thing, but that idea of explaining that you've got these choices, you've got all of these memories of your son. Do you want to remember all of the beautiful, amazing things? Are those the memories that you want to have come to mind? Of course they are. How is that going to manifest if you're constantly keeping yourself in the negative space?
And it was hard to let that ball, as you said, that carrying that chain around. It was scary to cut that chain and let it go. But man, how amazing it's been since I was able to do that. And that wasn't a overnight thing. Of course, it took practice and little bits and pieces. People misinterpret the way that I am now, that I've always been this way. And all they have to do is ask a couple of my really close friends, and they'll tell you, this is not the way she was the first couple of years. You know?
Yeah.
This was terrible. It was terrible. I never thought I'd laugh and say that I'm enjoying life and that I love and am excited about things. How could I? That's so awesome that I can actually verbalize that I'm excited about the things that are ahead. Now, that being said, you know, I'm not afraid to die either.
Yeah.
When that happens, I know there's a whole other spiritual realm beyond this, and I'm okay with that. And I'm whatever that looks like. I'm not going to pursue it, but I'm not afraid of it.
Yeah. I think it's important for us to find ways forward, especially if you want to honor the memory. You wouldn't want them to know that the decision they made completely destroyed everyone around them.
Right. No, boy, I sure didn't. Because he didn't make that in his right mind at that moment. That was an impulsive, painful moment that wasn't, he would never have wanted to influence his friends in that way. It was just pain.
Did you ever get any answers for why?
Yeah, I mean, there were a culmination of several different things that contributed to that one moment. One of it, the most important being, he started taking a drug called Accutane, which is for acne, about 4 months before he passed. And that drug, I did have to sign a waiver. So, I mean, talk about feeling like a shitty parent.
I had
to sign that waiver that said suicide, psychosis, and depression are potential side effects. But it never crossed my mind that that could pertain to me, because my kid, that, I mean, I, all the drugs say that.
Yeah, everything
that we, does. So it didn't even, not even a blimp on the radar screen. And it was only after he passed when the dermatologist called me wanting to talk to me. And he said, Leanne, because he had to see Andy, they had to do counseling every month with this drug. They did blood tests every month. And he said, so he got to know Andy. And he said, I want you to know that Andy was the most well-adjusted kid I've ever met. It's the most devastating news, and I've reported it to the FDA that the Accutane caused Andy's suicide. And then I started to do the research on the drug, and one of the places of impact, you know, that it can affect is their frontal lobe, which is where their clear thinking was.
Yes.
And they could be forgetful, and it can impede their, you know, clear thinking process. They're processing the challenging things. And so he was having some forgetful moments. He'd never struggled in school, and all of a sudden he was struggling, and he was forgetting how to drive certain places. Well, Andy loved to drive, and we'd been to the baseball field because we lived at the baseball field. So for him to forget how to get there was odd. And so that was beginning to impact his ability to think. And then he had a breakup with a girlfriend, and that was affecting his heart.
Yeah.
And then he had a teacher who was bullying him because he was the funny, happy kid in class, the one that brings the big gulp to school and does backflips in the hall. She didn't like that. And so she was going to fail him in that one class. And that would have made him ineligible for baseball. That was literally, the coach from Annapolis was calling him every week wanting to know what his GPA was. So in Andy's mind, if you add those things together, it was December, so you've got the holidays, you've got the end of the semester, the beginning of baseball season in January, his heart's broken, and he's not thinking clearly, and then he watched a music video moments before he ended his life, and that music video depicts exactly what Andy did that day from the moment he got up. And the deputy told me, he said, because they confiscated his computer and his phones and stuff, and when I was able to get him back, he said, Leanne, I want you to know that Andy watched this music video and you should watch it. And so I did. And I was, not only had Andy watched it once, but he had watched it. The history showed that he'd watched it before. And that was reinforcing that video. You know, it didn't come out and say, hey, kid, do this. But it, I mean, literally from exactly, he went and got takeout at lunchtime, Asian food, and Andy did that. And he had a breakup with a girlfriend in the video. Andy had a breakup with the girlfriend. The kid left school. Andy left school. I mean, on and on. And so with a brain that's not thinking clearly and a heart that's not thinking clearly, all this did was reinforce that sadness and gave him permission to act upon it in that moment of despair. So those are some of the things that I share when I'm speaking to kids, anybody. What are we taking in on a daily basis? What kind of music are we listening to? What kind of videos are you playing? What kind of TV shows? What kind of political shows are you watching? I mean, to the adults, how does that transform you? Do you get angry? Do you get agitated when you're watching them? You know, being cautious about everything we're taking in on a daily basis on our social media, it's impacting us. We have to take ownership of that again.
And there are a lot of things that you can take away from, things like music videos and art, and especially when you're a teenager, You know, you're constantly looking, excuse me, you're constantly looking for boxes to put your confusing emotions in. And so when you find something that speaks to you on a certain level, sometimes, it is a lot to take in. You know, all of the regular teenage feelings that you're constantly having, it's a lot to go through and to tell somebody that it, you know, it's, oh, this is just a small thing, you know, someday you'll feel better. It's not what you want to hear at that given moment.
Well, and they don't have any perspective like you and I do.
Yeah.
Well, and you having experienced that as a teenager, you understand that, you know, that it feels like it's the end of the world to them. I mean, not getting invited to prom or homecoming or, or failing a class, you know, it feels like it's the end of the world. So the more that we can do, the presentations that I, when I'm talking to kids, I start out in, immediately by saying, everybody else is really focused on your success, your teachers, your parents, and I'm here to tell you how important it is for you to fail, because your failures and your losses are where you understand and learn and grow and gain strength that you can face and get prepared for your successes. So to understand that they're normal, they're an important part of life. Loss is a part of life. Failing is a part of life. It is normal. You should expect it and anticipate it. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't strive for success, but that we should look at failures in a different way than, you know, the end of the world.
Yeah, failure is so necessary.
Yeah.
For you to be able to succeed at anything, you've got to know how to get better. The only way to do that is to make some mistakes and adjust.
Yeah. I get a lot of, you can see a lot of light bulbs go off with some of the people when I'm talking about that. And they're like, oh, okay, thank you. You know, that helps me. That gives me some courage that I'm not alone. I mean, that's our biggest thing in life is we don't want to feel alone. We don't want to feel like we're alone in our sorrow, in our struggles. We want to feel connected to someone else. And so when someone else shares and is vulnerable enough, like you and I, to share that the things that we've gone through, then that opens up that conversation for someone else to feel connected and feel like they're not alone. So the more that people like you and me can talk about this, I think the greater likely, I mean, I do, I get the letters all the time. Thank you. You've saved my life. So that really, you know, that's pretty amazing that a simple conversation could impact someone so immensely that it might alter their course.
Well, and I thank you for this conversation today.
Well, and you're the brave one for having the podcast. So kudos to you for doing this, you know?
Well, thank you. Thanks for talking to me today.
You too, Chris. Thanks so much.
And there you have it. Now, that was an awesome conversation, but there's so much more information available. And where are you going to get that? You're going to go to leannehull.com and pick yourself up the book, How to Live When You Want to Die. As for me, I have got a show coming up at the Buntport Theater on LePan Street in Denver, Colorado, October 21st. That is this coming up Monday, where I'll be telling a brand new stand-up comedy-ish story about something very, very shameful that I'm not going to share on this podcast. So if you can make it in town, I highly recommend you come to this show, because ultimately, we all have to get through everything we've been through, and it's best to do it with friends. So, don't kill yourselves out there.